Cesar Millan achieved a little bit of notoriety through his television show several years back called The Dog Whisperer. In every episode, he would show up to somebody's house, and there was canine chaos. The dogs were out of control. The owners were at their wits' end. And by the end of the episode, after Caesar had trained mostly the owner and also the dog, they would leave in great peace. Everyone was happier about it. Author Malcolm Gladwell tells the story of when he visited Caesar's dog psychology office, where Caesar houses his own personal, get this, 47 dogs. As they went out back to the huge dog run, Caesar told Malcolm, "This here is our Chuck E. Cheese." And he got one of those plastic ball throwers and started heaving tennis balls in every different direction. And the dogs were just lapping it up, having a great time, bouncing all over each other, yelping out loud. And Caesar told Malcolm, "You know, the game should be played for 5, 10 minutes, 15 max. You start, you stop." In the middle of the chaos of joy that was happening in the back, Caesar eventually let out a really sharp whistle. Total silence. Standing erect in the middle of 47 dogs, they all stood as still as he did. And almost imperceptibly, Caesar nodded his head in the direction of which he wanted the dogs to go, and they all happily lined up and went back into the house. I kind of want to be one of those dogs. Totally self-controlled under the direction of my master. Have complete self-control under the direction of my master, surrendered to him. Church's Advent gets rolling next week. We are going to be wrapping up today our series that has been called The Jesus-Shaped Heart. The big idea is that people who are apprenticing their lives, who are becoming disciples, that is, of Jesus, we're having our lives be transformed to function like he did on this earth. And to do that, we've been looking at what Paul has called the fruit of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit. The fruit, we've interpreted that as love, and all the other things that follow are expressions of what the love of the Spirit brings in our life. And today we're going to be looking at self-control. Just in time for the holidays. Funny how God does stuff like that. You know, most every human can recognize that certain thoughts and behaviors are damaging to ourselves and to other people. Essentially, everybody can see that. And most people can see, well, certain thoughts and behaviors are helpful to other people. And most of us can recognize and identify with the words of Paul when he says in Romans chapter 7 this, "I don't understand what my own actions are all about. I don't do what I want to do, and I do the very things that I hate." Most of us can see this is good stuff for me and others. This is bad stuff for me and others. But why aren't I just doing the good stuff? That is, we lack self-control. For whatever reason, we lack self-control. You know, why did I say that? Why did I eat that? Why did I buy that? Why did I watch that? For some reason, we do the thing that we hate. The scriptures, though, give us really good news. We learn to trust that living surrendered under God's Spirit and being trained in godliness, we live with a greater sense of self-control. Self-control is a super easy concept to understand. It's just power over something. This is doing what I want it to do. It's an incredibly challenging issue to be able to have come alive in our life, to be the natural result of our living. And I want to start this whole concept about training in order to be self-controlled to say that training can and is often done in a very wrong way, especially when it comes to training in our faith. Some of us here are probably people that have been trained in awkward ways within our faith, who have been told things or things have happened to us. We've received them in the wrong way. It's really the central conflict that drives Jesus' life. The people who were trained in godliness, they knew the law better than anyone, and they put Jesus on the cross because they received the training in the wrong way. It's what motivates his telling of the story of the two sons who were off track. The two prodigal sons, really, is what that story is about. The first son, the younger one, classic rebel, a wild man, giving full vent to his selfishness and living the kind of life that he thinks is what he wants. He essentially says to his father, I'd rather have you dead so that I could have your money, so that I could live the kind of life that I think that I want to live. Takes his money, goes off and squandered his living. Shockingly, that didn't work out. He comes home, into which we're introduced to the older brother, equally off the rails, just on the other side of the track. Equally off the rails, but on the other side of the track. He hears and understands from another servant that his father has not only welcomed home his son, but he's throwing him a huge party where he killed the prized animal, the fatted calf, and is celebrating lavishly with it was because of his son's return. And his response reveals where his heart is, which is what indicates to us that we've received training in the wrong way. Instead of gratitude, instead of joy, instead of forgiveness, he's bitter. He's both bitter and entitled. We know we're receiving our faith training in the wrong way when this what's dominating our thoughts during the day, or at least infusing within them, is a bitterness and an entitlement. Why did he get that fatted calf killed for him? My dad never even gave me a goat so I could celebrate with my friends. The place his heart is one of bitterness and an entitlement. And that's how we know we have received the training in the wrong way. So I want to acknowledge that there's a wrong way to do training and as much to receive training. And it's characterized by our bitterness and our entitlement about what's happening in life. But if we can let the door stay open for a moment here this morning and look at training from a different perspective, and we can allow the Holy Spirit to work in our lives to train us to become a little bit more like Caesar Milan's dogs, learning how to trust and be trained in the King's ways, which really does lead to a better life for everybody. Scripture has a fair amount to say about actual training, the specificness of training, because especially those within the Protestant tradition in which we are in, it almost seems like we're not supposed to do training. Like we're just supposed to pray about something and then it comes alive in our life. Or that it seems like we're trying to earn God's favor when really God's not asking us to earn his favor. He's just asking us to apply effort in order to be trained in a new way. Look what Peter says in 2 Peter in the first chapter. For this very reason, you must make every effort to support your faith with goodness, and goodness knowledge, and knowledge self-control, and self-control endurance, and endurance godliness, and godliness mutual affection, and mutual affection with love. Okay, Paul uses himself as an example in 1 Corinthians. He says it this way. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air, but I punish my body and I enslave it. Paul then goes on to instruct one of his proteges named Timothy when he says this, in 2 Corinthians and then Timothy. And we take every thought captive to obey Christ. And then he says to Timothy, train yourself in godliness. We know that if we just let ourselves go, if we just follow our gut or something, Oftentimes, destruction follows that as well. Paul in the New Testament is here saying very intentionally, very directly, there's a training process that we all go through. We know it can get done wrong, but there's also a way to do it right. We don't throw out training altogether just because it's gone wrong at certain times. And I want to tell you on a personal level, I find this truth to be delightful. I find it to be absolutely delightful in my life right now that there's the truth that there's a mechanical element to my soul. There's a mechanical element to myself, an element. There's a mechanical element to who I am. We all know that that's true with our physical body. What we do with it mechanically determines what it's like. We all know that's true with things like our finances. Often as we, you know, whatever we're doing with it on a mechanical level, that's how they turn out. And what is true also is there is a mechanical element to my soul. We can be trained because let's face it, too many of our thoughts during the course of a given day, which I'm told we each have about 60 to 80,000 thoughts during a given day, most of them are nonsense. Most of them are these weird rabbit trails. Most of them don't even have a cohesion to them. There's a delightful element to the mechanical level of our soul, I find, because it helps to further remove the debilitating shame that most of us live under most of the time. You see, most of the time we're living under some sort of, I should have done this. Why did I say that? How come I keep finding myself in this place? We don't have to shame ourselves like that. Christ went to the cross to forgive us, to reconcile us, and God did. And we can see ourselves now more as, this is just an issue of training. I'm doing this because I've been trained to do this, I want to do this, and so it's really a simple issue of training. And if I get the right vision and the right training, we'll be able to pull it together. There is a delightfully mechanical element to how God has designed us, has put us all together. And of the billions of humans that have lived on this planet before, we are in the generation that is fortunate enough to live in a time that really understands our design better than others have understood it before. Our brains, you see, they contain billions of different neurons. It exists within colonies inside of our head that communicate to one another, sending literally electronic messages through chemicals where they're building equilibriums that build actual paths. John Rady is the Harvard psych head guy, and he says the simple phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. And many of us know this stuff, and it builds an actual physical path in your brain. So when we talk about equilibriums, like each one of us has a normal how much we sleep, or the kind of food that we eat during the day, or how it is that we respond to authority, or when a conflict comes about, what do we do? Those are equilibriums all set in our head because these colonies of neurons are communicating to one another, and they've set an equilibrium. And the more often you do things, the more stabilized the path is in your head. So if you just imagine like a single-track trail in the wilderness that only a few people have ridden on, that's some kind of pattern that's only happened a few times. But then if we think of things that we do all the time, every single day, which we are training ourselves every day towards something. Make no mistake, you're not training yourself or not training yourself. You are training yourself towards something every single day. But if you've been doing something for 10, 20, 30 years, it's like an 8-lane highway in our brain. The great news is about the way the Father designed us is that those pathways can physically change. It's called neuroplasticity. We've known about this for some time now. You can get scans of the brain and you can see how they once operated and you can see that somebody gets trained to do something differently and they come about in a different kind of a way. And that's what changes us. It's the pattern. It's what the Holy Spirit is looking like when it shows up in our own head. We can change the pathways. We can become different people. And I want to offer for you this biblical model for what the training in self-control can look like that has meant an extraordinarily great deal to me. I just finished my year two of this degree program that I went back to study for, and I know that everyone here is going to want to read that paper because it's 34 pages on me. Just form a line to get the paper. Part of this paper was developing what's called a rule of life. It's a Benedictine practice where you set up the structures, the disciplines, the people in your life that you need to become the best you in the given context that you're in right now. What needs to be a part of my life in order to be the best version of me? And I use this model, which comes to us in two parts because it's meant so much to me. And I have offered it to you before. So for the astute student out there, impress your friends and neighbors. If you actually know what's coming next, call it out. I challenge you to do that. I don't know if anybody would. But we are human beings, and we all have blind spots, correct? And so we can call our blind spots simply this. Unconscious incompetence. We don't even know that we're doing damage to other people. And far worse than that, that you're doing damage, we are leaving untapped potential on the table. This is Peter when he starts following Jesus. He doesn't even know that he's not living a life that would please God. Eventually, his life would be used by God to change the course of human history. He was leaving all that potential on the boat, so to speak, when he was just a fisherman. And then he becomes, does anybody know what's next? Wow, that's so great. Conscious incompetence. Jesus has this miraculous catch of fish, so much that his boats are almost going to sink. And Peter responds by saying, get away from me, I am a sinful man. Something changed in his life that he recognized, wow, I'm way off base. He is consciously incompetent. But as we see throughout the Gospels in the book of Acts and his own letters, Peter starts to change. He receives the training process, and the next step in that is? We see Peter learning to lead. We see him learning how to heal people. We see him learning how to use his big fat voice in order to do godly things and not ungodly things, to lead people along those traps. And the last phase of the story is, I'm so impressed with you. Give yourself a gold star today. Unconscious competence. This is Peter in Acts chapter 3. He's received the Spirit. He's done miracles before, and he's walking with John outside of the temple, and a beggar asks him, can you give me some money? And he says to him, silver and gold have I, right out of his mouth, silver and gold have we none, but what we do have we'll give you. Rise and walk. And the man does. He's unconscious. He doesn't have to think about it. He doesn't have to process it. It's just right there with who he is and how he is living his life. That's the first part of this thing. And the second part of the model is the research that came out of John Hopkins Medical some time ago now and was captured in Alan Dutchman's book called Change or Die. At the time the book was written, in our country, roughly 600,000 people every year have to have a heart surgery, and about 1.3 million have to have an angioplasty done so that they can survive. At the time when this research was done, the essential response to people who had these conditions was, look, if you don't change your lifestyle, within a couple years, you will die. You'll be dead unless you make some changes. You would think that would get people to change, wouldn't it? And what happened was in 2 years, they discovered 90% of the people make zero changes within their life, right? And the part of the reason why they used to tell them that is because that we usually think that people are logical. And so if we give them facts, they'll make the right decision. That's the most illogical thing we could think. People are not logical. There's a zillion factors that influence the kind of decisions that we make. But if we're just offering people facts and we think they make the right decision, we usually don't. We also think that if we scare people, you know, if we offer enough fear, then people will die. Your life will end. No more breathing. That's it. We think that would actually motivate somebody to change, but the truth of the matter is fear doesn't change people's hearts and ultimately their behavior. The best that it can do is for a short period of time control your external behavior. We also think, finally, that we can force people to change. If anybody could force somebody to change, don't you think it would be Jesus? Yet, the Gospels are loaded with accounts of people interacting with Jesus and them walking the other direction. Wouldn't you think Jesus would be able to somehow force them to come and follow him and live after him? But Jesus knows, I can't force you to do this. The impetus has to be on you. And this is how I then framed my own particular rule of life around the three R's. And if you know these, you can call them out too. I've used this one before as well. The first one is reframe. We have to reframe. We have to take a different kind of look and honestly answer the question, what do I want? How you answer that question is your vision for your life. And you all have one. And what is that frame? What is that vision? And have you answered it honestly? I tell myself often, you know what I want? I want to lose 10 pounds. But then I find myself watching Netflix eating chips. What do I really want? What's the honest answer to what I want? I want entertainment that requires nothing of me while I eat unhealthy food. It's pretty much what I want. If I really wanted to lose the 10 pounds, I would do something about it. We have to honestly answer the question, what do I want? This is Hebrews chapter 12. But for the sake of joy set before him, he endured the cross. Jesus knew with clarity what he wanted. His vision was clear. His frame was clear. I want the joy of seeing this world reconciled to my Father. And I'll endure anything in order to get there. We have to honestly answer the question. And we're talking about change. I am on the couch with the chips because that's my true vision. And we have to reframe that, get a different kind of vision. And as with all of our Christian faith, it cannot be done alone. It must be done with people. We have to relate differently. Isolation is a destroyer for us. All of our faith, you cannot be a Christian, a follower of Jesus, without other people. Jesus could have done the task that he had to do alone, but he recruited 12, and then he had several on the outside of that, but he deeply related with three who knew his heart, who he spent the most time with, because even he had the limitations of how many people he could let into that deep space. And so we have to do this with other people. What we want, and sometimes even what we're taught, is that we want to make a change, we just get on our knees and pray really hard. That's actually a whole different model of change. That's like, I have a phone and it does this, but I want it to do that, so I just add an app. That's what we want to happen to our character, but the truth is, God wears people. And we relate with them and interact with them, and that's how change comes about. When we have a different vision, we've got different people joining us in on that vision. Hear how Paul talks about it in 2 Corinthians. You know what? I don't think I got that one. Never mind about what Paul thought about it. But he talks about how God is the God of comfort, and God comforted us by sending us Titus. How did God work? By giving us miraculous vibes or something? No, by sending us a person, a human. God wears humans and relates to us with them. So when we know where to go and we know what it is that we want and who's going with us, we then do the final R, which is repeat. This is the mechanical element. This is the conscious competence. This is the, I know where I want to go and I continue repeating this. Richard Feynman was born in 1918 and was said to be a typical child prodigy. When he found something that he loved, he just did it over and over and over again and never grew weary of it. Richard loved science. And so he became quite the scientist, and in 1965 ended up winning the Nobel Prize for Physics. Turns out that his younger sister, Joan, also had an interest in science. But because of the time of life that she lived, their mother thought that girls were physiologically incapable of learning science. So she didn't pursue it in her younger days. On her 13th birthday, Richard gave her a college-level book on astronomy. And when she opened it, she was moved to see that her brother had written her name on the inside cover. But then when she turned the pages, she said, well, how will I ever understand this? It's so hard. And Richard gave her these words of truth that are true for all of our training. He said to her, Joan, you start at the beginning and you read as far as you can until you get lost. Then you start at the beginning again and read as far as you can get until you work through the whole book and understand it. Joan took her older brother's advice, and in 1958, she earned her PhD in physics. It's how training works in our life. We start at the beginning and we work until we get confused, and then we start over again and continue to work after it. Okay, so now that the concepts are out there, before you race off and go and train into the perfect human, I want to offer you two quick words about what will probably derail you in the process. What's probably going to get into your way. Before we can get to the top of the mountain, we've got to make the entire journey. Oftentimes in our world, I'll just say it first, we think that accurate thinking is enough. We think that accurate thinking is enough. I learned that little bit about the brain and how it works when I was on sabbatical and reading a lot about the brain in 2005. And I would tell everybody who would listen to me. It was so shockingly new. I didn't actually start doing different things for about another 5 or 6 years that would train myself to have different character. I thought because I knew how it worked, that was enough. Knowing how the issue works is like finding the trailhead. And then every step of the way, we gloriously get closer and closer to the summit. Knowing how, I've heard several different counselors tell me this on multiple occasions. Yeah, it's a huge problem in couples counseling. Oftentimes, the guy thinks that once he understands the problem, it's resolved. The truth is just the opposite. We all have to engage a training process when we're going to try to become something new. I read for the first time in my life a book about negotiations about 6 months ago. I'm horrible at negotiations, financial ones. I'm just terrible. After I finished the book, it was all new and brilliant for me, and so I just loved it, and I deeply understood the concepts in my head, yet failed miserably at the next 3 financial negotiations that I engaged in. Because I hadn't had the training yet. The understanding is one thing. That if we think we have resolved the issue because we understand the issue, we will be derailed. We absolutely will. The second is that we all fear failure. We all fear failure. I want to become a better self-controlled person, but we fear the failure of ending another week thinking, I've already tried to do this and it didn't come out the right way. I don't want to be in that place again, so I'll avoid even trying this. It's just who I am. As human beings, we all have huge loss aversion, and so we typically gravitate towards the things that we already know, and we have to recognize that change always requires some sort of risk. Okay, for the last 4 years now, when I drive around in my car during the week, I listen to these Spanish lessons for like 25, 30 minutes about 4 or 5 times a week. And it's super fun to imagine myself being in Nicaragua having a real conversation with Pastor Francisco, our partner church down there. And I'm kind of getting somewhere with the thing. I'm learning. And it was 2 weeks ago now. I was down in Loveland, and I went into the Tortilla La Auténtica. And I ordered 2 tacos and a smothered burrito. And I knew every single word to make the order. And I knew every single answer to the questions that she had for me. And I knew every single question that I wanted to say to her right away in Spanish. I was so impressed with myself. So I got my food and I walked out the restaurant having said every single word in English. ¿Por qué? I didn't want to look like an idiot and have her ask me a question that I didn't know the answer to. I didn't want to look foolish and, oh, I don't speak Spanish. No, you don't. I didn't want to take that risk. We all fear failure. We have huge loss aversion. We gravitate. Church, let me ask you, when was the last time that you thought, you hesitated and thought, if I ask that question, if I do this, there's a great potential that I'll look foolish. And did it anyway. We all have a great sense of intuition about when we're going to look foolish or awkward, and most of the time we back down. Yet that type of failure that needs to be renamed is absolutely necessary for us to grow in anything. Okay, in a totally uncharacteristic fashion, I want to leave us all here this Thanksgiving week with a very specific ask of you here as we close out our time. Being trained in godliness, you know, letting our master teach us how it is that we get along with the other dogs in the pack and make the world a better place for all of us. None of us is perfect. And so when we look at that list that Paul offers as a partial fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, I'm sure each one of us can identify, you know, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control, etc. We could all look at that list and say, aha, I am so impatient. I am so rude. I find myself just being rude. I'm sure we can all identify something within that list, and I'm sure we can all identify in our heads, this person, though, is just kind. They are kind, or they are so patient. Or whichever your particulars are. I'm asking this, if you will identify which of those is the biggest one for you, who that person is, and then craft at least two or three questions that you can ask that person to help make that become more a part of your reality. Affirm that person by saying, I see this in you. I see you being kind to those who aren't being kind to you. I see you being really gentle. And then having two or three questions as you've formulated to say, I want this to be more a part of my life, and then throwing it at them. Don't ask them to be your mentor for the next year and a half. Don't even use that word. Just say, I see this in you, and I'm wondering if you would spill on me a little bit of the specifically related questions that I've got for you, because I want that to be more a part of the natural process of my own life, and I bet that you could train me a little bit in it. So living God, we each one of us need and want to receive the grace that you want to give us today. Lord, that you would train us in your ways. That we would find the others, that we would find the vision, that we would find the repetitive patterns, Lord, that your Spirit desires to work with us in, so that our lives would then naturally produce the kind of fruit that your Spirit wants to give. Jesus, we pray this in your matchless name that can raise the dead. Amen.